Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report, Left Behind, The Rapture Story, right after this. Well, biotech beans, chemical corn, frankenfish, and the pesticide potato. That's what's on the menu down at your local neighborhood supermarket. And we're concerned that this technology is a serious threat to our health, to traditionally bred open-pollinated seeds, and to the environment and the farmers that grow them. Listen to this quotation from the Chicago Tribune, which said recently, "We are being exposed to one of the largest uncontrolled experiments in history. In less than 5 years, these companies have flooded the marketplace with thousands of untested and unlabeled products containing foreign genetic material. These genetically modified organisms pose several real dangers because they have been engineered to create novel proteins that retard spoilage, produce their own pesticides against insects, or allow the plants to tolerate larger and larger doses of weed killers. And what is really scary is that this isn't from Tom Clancy's latest thriller. These seeds are already a major part of the U.S. corn and soybean crop. Now, what happens if one of these so-called suicide genes, which prevents seed saving, what if it goes haywire and destroys the entire U.S. corn crop? Or what if it turns out that genetically modified rice kills people? Or what if we find out that genetic mutations are birth defects in people, like thalidomide, are caused by these GM foods? Well, I don't want to take that kind of risk, and I'll just bet that you don't want to be a guinea pig in this ill-advised experiment either. Now, the law school has a program to teach you how to make $100,000 on 25 acres or less. Now, that's a five-day school. Remember, there's about 35 million people in this country that want organic, clean, good, nutritious food. This five-day school includes lessons on marketing, business plans, growing organic foods. Why don't you call today and order that free four-hour CD package? It's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Remember, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about Left Behind. Remember, it was Tim LaHaye, he and a writer, a fellow writer, working together, have now written 14 books, which deal with this thing called the Rapture Theory. Last time we took a look at where the rapture theory came from. It was from a Jesuit priest writing under a Jewish pseudonym back in 1812 that published the theory of the rapture. It was picked up and it has been moved through theological circles from England around the world until today, here in America at least. One out of every four people in this country believe in the rapture. So I ask the question, why are these people so much smarter than I am? Surely not all of them have PhDs. Surely some of these people have not gone to college. I didn't go to college, and so I'm not very smart. I don't have any letters after my name, and I don't believe in the rapture. And I just thought that maybe we ought to look at information control for social manipulation to see if whether or not there might be a connection between mass brainwashing or mass hysteria or a belief that is held by millions of people that's untrue. After all, we all have to admit, out of 6 billion people in the world, 1 billion of them are Muslims, and you and I don't believe those Muslims have a leg to stand on, now do we? I mean, if we did, wouldn't we be Muslims also? Now, can a billion people be wrong? Could a billion Muslims have made a horrendous mistake and believe a lie? God, that doesn't sound very logical. And yet, Tim LaHaye said that if you don't believe in the rapture theory, you're going to go to hell. Well, I'm one of those that doesn't believe in the rapture theory. Now, you'd think if I had a brain in my head, I'd rush right out and start believing in the rapture theory. But unfortunately, I've discovered in my lifetime that I can't control what I believe by turning it on and off like the hot water faucet. Beliefs are kind of personal, ain't they? I mean, what you believe is kind of unique and personal just to you. And if I come along and say, you know, if you don't believe what I believe, you're going to go to hell, that may be true, but that isn't going to change your belief. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Now, you know that as well as I do. So I thought, well, this time let's take a look at why it is that we believe what we believe. So we started off, and I told you last time that the guy that wrote this, it's his master's thesis. The guy's name is David DeSerino. D-E-S-E-R-A-N-O. DeSerino. DeSerino, maybe. Anyway, he's a recent graduate from Portland State University, Oregon, with an M.S. in communication theory. Now, you know this guy's smart. He's got letters behind his name. Much of his time has been spent researching and documenting the numerous links between the U.S. government and a supposedly free media. He has turned this article, which originated in his master's thesis, into an illustrated Zine, Z-I-N-E, I guess, magazine article. To contact David DeSerino, you can email him at 42ent, that's 40, F-O-R-T-Y, T-W-O-E-N-T, at yahoo.com. Now, the full text of this article, with all of his references, is posted at the Nexus website. So if you go to www.nexusmagazine.com, www.nexusmagazine.com, you can, free of charge, get this entire master's thesis. Now, I did that. It's 48 pages. I thought it was well worth the time, effort, and energy that I spent looking it up. So let me share it with you. Joseph Goebbels. Remember that name, Joseph Goebbels? He was the propaganda minister of the Third Reich. He was one of Hitler's closest aides. He said, it would not be impossible to prove with sufficient repetition and a psychological understanding of the people concerned that a square is in fact a circle. They are, after all, mere words, and words can be molded until they clothe ideas in disguise. I guess that's kind of like, give me a kid till he's 7 years old and you'll be a Catholic for life, where if you repeat a lie often enough and over again, people will believe it. Well, this guy ought to know. I mean, after all, he was the propaganda minister. He got 80 million Germans to follow Adolf Hitler. They believed he was the Messiah. He was telling the truth. He was the great guru. Of course, the rest of us out here, we didn't believe that. Why did 80 million Germans believe in Hitler and 140 million Americans? We didn't. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense, does it? Now, you'd think if this guy Hitler was as smart as we give him credit for, we'd have all been believing in him. Well, the article starts by saying, the United States is the most media-saturated country in the world, and we're bombarded daily with thousands upon thousands of images and sounds designed to get our attention, to entertain us, to inform us of everything from shoes to food to celebrity-tum to political ideology. It's been estimated that the average American is exposed to more than 3,000 advertisements every day. Did you get that number? 3,000 advertisements every day. But on top of that, there are the news programs, sitcoms, films, radio, and other forms of media that we choose to consume. All of this works to shape our opinions of the world, and a great deal of time, effort, and money is spent to guide our opinions down particular avenues. This used to be called propaganda. Well, the first thing I want to underline here is 3,000 advertisements a day, I think, is probably a misprint. I'd say maybe 300 advertisements a day, because I'm only up and looking at things, you know, maybe 8 hours a day. So if we had 300 divided by 8, well, that'd be 37 advertisements an hour. I don't think I'm exposed to 37 advertisements an hour. That's kind of my observation. I don't know why he got to thinking that 3,000 advertisements every day, but maybe 30 a day. I'd say I'm probably exposed to 30. Well, today, with the negative Nazi-esque connotation which comes with that word, euphemisms such as misinformation or disinformation or image consulting or political consulting, news consulting, advertising, infomercials, public relations, damage control, and the art of spin have now taken the place of propaganda in the English lexicon, all but concealing its true nature and omnipotence and omnipresence. And omnipresent it is. You see, the industries that deal with information control in both the commercial and governmental sectors work with hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Uninformed, ignorant masses are far easier to manipulate than educated, thinking masses. So we have to ask, who has all of this information? And how is this information being distributed? And how is all of this information being contextualized? Corporations and governments have spent many decades and hundreds of billions of dollars researching how best to influence people. And much of this information is kept secret from the public. In the case of corporate research, it is their private property. And what is known has come from the more recent work done by scholars around the world, work that is dramatically underfunded by comparison. So the information available to the average citizen, including the aforementioned academic scholars, is radically less than that which is available to the producers of media or information campaigns, for example, advertising agencies, public relations firms, or political consultants, for example. However, an important fact that is known is that the human brain processes different mediums in different ways. Written and spoken words are put through a type of decoding process wherein your brain deciphers the words and the sentence structure in order to interpret properly what it is that the brain is reading or hearing. In this process, both your conscious and your unconscious mind go through an internal debate comparing what it is interpreting with what it already knows to be true. Let me pause here for a moment. What does your brain already know to be true? Well, isn't it the information that you've already got stored there? What if the information that you've already got stored in your brain is false information? Then, new information comes into your brain which contradicts this false information that's already in your brain. Well, what does your brain do? It rejects the new information because you've already got the truth. You already have a belief. Belief, then, is what you already know to be true. something that you've already accepted, like the world is round. You already know that. So if I come along and say the world is flat, well, then you reject that because you know that that's false. What if you believed the world was flat and I came along and said the world is round? Well, immediately your mind would reject this round theory because you already know, you've already accepted that the world is flat. Now, you know, I think all of us have been exposed to some information concerning smoking, haven't we? I mean, I smoked for 9 years, and one day I woke up after I received some information from the Reader's Digest. I read an article in Reader's Digest back in the early 1960s concerning smoking. And they were just then beginning to put the connecting link with smoking and lung cancer. Well, you see, when I was a child growing up, they used to advertise Camel cigarettes, and they had a T, and they would say it was good for your T-zone, that smoking was good for your throat, that smoking was healthful. It was good for you. That was what they used to advertise in the 1930s and 40s when I was a kid. Well, by the 1950s, some people started asking questions like, gee, is this smoking really as good as we thought it was? By the 1960s, they came up with the conclusion that, no, this smoking causes cancer. Now, of course, the tobacco industry denied that. And they said, oh, no, it doesn't cause cancer. That's just somebody's theory. And for 40 years, we've been arguing back and forth over this smoking and non-smoking thing. Well, finally, we just found out, didn't we? Just in the last 5 years. Well, you know, 5-10 years. That the tobacco industry knew that it was causing cancer, and they had the statistics that went right along with the medicos, but they suppressed it. Have you heard that story? Now, I find it hard to believe that there's anybody left in America. I can't speak for you Canadians and Australians, man. After all, you people aren't very smart in Australia and New Zealand, though, are you? I mean, after all, we Americans see ourselves as being smarter than everybody else in the world. Just look at us. So therefore, you can't be very bright. But even in your darkened minds, have you ever heard that smoking might be bad for your health? That it might cause heart disease, stroke, and cancer, and a whole host and plethora of other diseases? Has it come to your attention? Has anybody ever said that? Whether you believe it or not, you've at least heard it, haven't you? Now, you'd think that anything as important as your health, and if somebody came along and challenged you and said smoking causes cancer, whether you smoke or not, you'd think that you'd want to know more about that. Well, I did back in the 1960s, and I said, well, gee, I'm a smoker, and if this smoking causes cancer, that would concern me. So I read the article, and then I looked at other articles, and I changed my opinion. I changed my mind. I changed my belief. I became a non-smoker. I quit smoking back about 1963, 62, along in there. Now, people who smoke today have a different belief than I do, don't they? Obviously, they believe that smoking is healthful and nutritious, and it's good for you, or in any event, it doesn't cause any harm. I mean, nobody in his right mind would go out and cause himself harm, no, would he? I mean, people wouldn't ingest cocaine and marijuana and heroin and Vioxx and all of these drugs now, if they knew those drugs were harmful, would they? So when people take drugs, they must believe that those drugs are good for them, while the rest of us who don't take drugs must believe that those drugs are bad for them. I mean, after all, guys, if I thought Vioxx was good for me, I'd be out and buying a couple of boxes today. All right, so then we have a belief that's in our minds based upon what we believe to be true, but where did we get this information? And is the information that's already in our minds true or false? And how are we going to tell? How are we going to figure this out? Well, listen up. With the image, however, the brain instantly processes it as truth, which means information presented in a visual format has a much greater impact on the unconscious or subconscious mind. So I'll just pause here. Let me make an observation. Television is much more influential over your belief processes or your mind than is radio or the printed word. If that statement is true, of course. All right, over long periods of time, recurring imagery has a build-up effect on the viewer, which allows for unconsciously received or conceived notions of truth to manifest as though from nowhere. So your beliefs just kind of come from nowhere. You just all of a sudden, hey, that's what I believe. Naturally then, whoever has control over the mediums of communication has a tremendous amount of power over the populations who consume it. Now you should note that in no way is this paper intended to convince readers of any particular conspiracy theory, but rather to present a collection of facts, all of which are readily available to the public, and allow readers to draw their own conclusions. The full article with references is available at www.nexusmagazine.com. And let me tell you, it is filled with all kinds of sources and footnotes. 48 pages. Now, Voltaire made this observation. He says, anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit injustices. So, first of all, let's start off here. The radio, the computer, and the internet are all products of the military. The radio was invented in the mid-1890s, and its first sale was to the British War Office in 1896 during the Boer War, and 3 years later to the United States Navy. During World War I, the United States put all commercial, amateur, and military, except for the Army's radio equipment, under the control of the Navy, a monopoly pursued immediately after the war as well. The first operational electronic computer, called Colossus, was built as a part of the Ultra project for the British Department of Communication in the Foreign Office to assist in the decoding of intercepted Nazi transmissions. The first electronic digital computer, ENIAC, the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, came out of a relationship between the Moore School of Electrical Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania and the Ballistics Research Lab, operated by the Army Ordnance Depot at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Aberdeen, Maryland. It was designed expressly for the solution of ballistics problems and for the printing of range tables. The grandparent of the Internet was the ARPANET, which came about in 1969. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, called DARPA, of the Department of Defense, wished to create a communications infrastructure for the United States military that could survive a nuclear attack. Many of the best attributes of the Internet, including its architecture, technology, gestalt, are the children of this military prototype. Now, at the outset of World War I in Europe, President Woodrow Wilson had to devise a way to convince the primarily pacifist American public to want to send their boys thousands of miles away to fight in a war that did not involve them directly. President Wilson came up with the Committee of Public Information, also known as the Creel Commission. It was made up of cartoonists, writers, editors, publishers, and others whose profession was to convey information to the masses, including Edward Bernays, father of the public relations industry, and Walter Lippmann, the dean of the American Journalists, a major foreign and domestic policy critic, and an important theorist of liberal democracy. Well, within a year, they were able to turn the American people into a fervent anti-German population. 1 year, 12 months, from pacifists to anti-German in 1 year. This exceedingly positive result caught the attention of two groups in particular. One was the intellectual community, who saw these new propaganda techniques. And keep in mind that in those days it was openly called propaganda at the time, as there wasn't a negative connotation to the word until the Nazis used many of these same techniques years later, during the 1930s and 40s. And they did this as a general means by which they could control the population on a regular basis. Now, the other group, besides the intellectuals, the other group comprised business leaders. Business leaders who saw a new window to increase their sales by turning the American people from a nation of producers into a population of consumers. What was ultimately learned from all of this was that in order to adequately persuade a population to do something, whether to go to war or to buy a hamburger, you needed to appeal to them on levels of which they are totally unconscious. Now, it's been noted that violence is to a dictatorship what propaganda is to a democracy. And the Nazis used both. Joseph Goebbels, appointed Reich Minister for Public Enlightenment and Propaganda, on March 14, 1933, combined the press, radio, film, theater, and propaganda into a single large-scale organization and considered the media as a piano in the hands of the government, on which the government could play. Now, although monotony may set in if all means reported the same information, Goebbels developed a theory that the media should be inform in principles, but polyform in nuances. Now, this is a concept that has been carried over into our media to this day. Well, let me pause here for a moment and point something out to you. Who first thought of coming up with taking the media and controlling it? Is that something that the Nazis thought up and, gee, let's see if we can control the media? No, it's one of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. So let me run through my little list here. We shall handle the press in the following manner. This is called the 12th protocol. We shall handle the press in the following manner. We shall saddle it and keep tight rein upon it. We shall do the same also with printed matter. For of what use is it to rid ourselves of attacks in the press if we remain exposed to criticism through pamphlets and books? Not one announcement will reach the people save under our supervision. We have attained this at the present time to the extent that all news is received through several agencies in which it is centralized from all parts of the world. Literature and journalism are two most important educational forces, and consequently, our government will become the owner of most of the journals. If we permit 10 private journals, we shall organize 30 of our own, and so on. This must not be suspected by the public, for which reason all of the journals published by us will be externally of the most contrary opinions and tendencies, thus evoking confidence in them and attracting our unsuspecting opponents, who thus will be caught in our trap and rendered harmless. The Protocols of the Learned Elders, published in 1884, republished again by Henry Ford from a French publication in 1909, I believe it was. Henry Ford published that in 1922 in the Dearborn Gazette. He bought a newspaper and said, I think I'll publish that. So before Goebbels got into the game in 1934, before Madison Avenue got into the game here in the United States, before Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected president, this concept of controlling masses of people through communication was already thunk up. It isn't something new, boys and girls. It's been around for a while. Now, although we have a tremendous amount of magazines and newspapers available to us, most of them are from highly centralized outlets that prefer a remarkably homogenized fare. News services for dailies throughout the entire nation are provided by the Associated Press, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post wire services, and then the several foreign wire services like Reuters. This ideological viewpoint of these news conduits are pretty much the same. They're marked by a prefabricated standardization of news which is constricting and frightening. Constricting and frightening, so says this author. Hey, hang on a second here. Let's take a break. Keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, the management, or the staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call 417-273-4967. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're talking about the rapture. Why do 70 million Americans believe in the rapture? That's one person in four, and the subject matter is the rapture. But before we get off into the rapture itself, I introduced you to the rapture concept in the last program, but now let's take a look at why it is that people believe what they believe. What causes you to believe what you believe? Whether you believe in the rapture or you don't believe in the rapture, the thing that triggered my interest was Tim LaHaye said, if you don't believe in the rapture, you're going to hell. That's what he told the interviewer on the Law Hour the other night. I don't believe in it, and so obviously Mr. LaHaye believes that George Gordon is going to hell because I don't believe in the rapture. Now, I could be deceived, so I pointed out to you that In Matthew 13, Jesus answered a question put to him. He said, why do you speak to these people in parables? And he said, I'm speaking to these people in parables because I don't want them to understand what I'm telling them. And he cited that directly out of Isaiah chapter 6. Now, it would seem like to me that that's grossly unfair, that Mr. LaHaye, understanding the rapture fully, believing in the rapture, and he's going to be protected from the tribulation, he's going to go to heaven or whatever it is that he's going to get because he's on the right side of the issue, and George Gordon's going to go to hell, going to get punished, go through the tribulation, because God has succeeded in doing what it is he does so well, and that is he has hidden it. He said he was going to hide it, that I'd be able to see it, but I wouldn't see. I'd hear it, but I wouldn't understand it. And he said, in me would be fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah. Now, it would seem like to me that it's grossly unfair to deceive me, hide this information from me, cause me to believe a lie, and then give all this good information to Mr. LaHaye and his followers, and they all go to heaven and get all the good benefits. Does that seem fair to you? So I thought, well, gee, maybe I better look into this a little bit deeper. And then I got to thinking about it. Says, my God, not only is little Georgie Gordon going to hell because he doesn't believe in the rapture, a billion Muslims are all going to hell because they don't believe in the rapture. And listen, if 70 million evangelicals, Christians, believe in the rapture and all the rest of the Christians don't, now I want to point this out to you. There's a billion Christians in the world. A billion. So let's just round this off. If 10% of those Christians were evangelicals believing in the rapture, 90% of them don't. 90% of the Christians are all going to hell along with all of the Muslims. looks like to me that God's coming out on the short end. He's going to end up with only 10% of the Christians, none of the Muslims, and then you still got 4 billion other people in the world, and that's just the people that are living today. What about the billions of people that have lived in the past, that have been born, lived their lives, and died, not believing in the rapture because the rapture theory didn't exist until 1812. Now that's a real dilemma for a dummy like me. Because if you have to believe in the rapture today to go to heaven, and if you don't believe in the rapture, you're going to go to hell. What about all those millions and billions and billions and billions of people that have lived before 1812 who never even heard of the rapture? You know, guys like Martin Luther, John Wycliffe. I mean, all these early reformers. Not to mention all the popes and all the Catholics before them. And what about all the people before Christians came on the scene? I mean, you know, you stop and think about what's being promulgated today. I mean, I didn't make these stories up, did I? I had a Mormon guy in here the other day just to kind of refresh my recollection. I said, is it still true that non-Mormons are going to hell? And he said, that's still true. I said, thank you. Well, my God, there's only 13 million Mormons in the world. Out of a billion. I mean, out of a billion Christians in the world, only 13 million are Mormons. So if you 13 million Mormons are all going to heaven, all the rest of us are going to hell, what does that mean? It means a billion Christians are going to hell and 13 million Mormons are going to heaven. Somehow that just doesn't add up. It seems like to me God should be smarter than that. That instead of hiding all of this from us, that maybe he should be more open, more forthright. That he should be sharing this information with more of us, don't you think? Or maybe God's got a plan that maybe the Mormons, the Christians, and the Muslims hadn't thought of. Maybe there's some third or fourth answer out here. Now, fear. Remember I've mentioned this, vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, or fear? Well, this author says, fear is a powerful means for establishing social control over a population. And the negative effects of media on its consumers are doing just that. For it's been widely established for decades that regular viewers of violent films and or television programming often look upon the world as being much more frightening, much more dangerous and violent than those who view the same media in much less quantity or not at all. The same, by the way, is also true of regular viewers of the evening news. All right, now let me point this out to you. Little Georgie Gordon watches the Dan Rather News Report every night, along with the Lair News Hour. I watch the BBC Report at 10:30. So I watch a full 2 hours of news a day, every day. And that's the minimum. I also watch Nova, Frontline, and other specials, in addition to reading newspapers, news magazines. I mean, all this information that I bring to you on the radio, I have to get it somewhere. I mean, you know, you got to be realistic. I don't have a degree. I'm not very smart. I didn't go to college, and because of that, I got to get the information from some place. And when I get all of this information, I've noticed that a lot of it is contradictory. A lot of it is contradictory. For instance, what I hear Dan Rather reporting on, and then what I hear Nexus News Magazine, or The Privateer, or Franklin Sanders Money Changer reporting on, are oftentimes at direct opposites. Politics, economics. So it shouldn't be surprising that a lot of this information, this religious information, is at exact opposite poles. I mean, it is just diametrically the opposite. So when a guy says, well, if you don't believe this, you're going to go to hell, little Georgie comes along and says, why? Well, because your belief is very important. Well, okay, but based upon what standard? Could you show me from the scripture, for instance, where it says if you don't believe all the right things, you're going to go to hell and fry for eternity? Can you show me that? Or is that a conclusion that you arrive at based upon the input of evidence that you've received? Because based upon the evidence that I've received, the input that's gone into my computer, sitting on top of my shoulder, tells me something different than that. Which is why I raised this issue. Because, as I mentioned earlier, a guy came up to my wife and said, "Do you believe in the rapture?" And she said, "Yes, I do. It happened 2 years ago." I get asked that quite often. I guess people want to know if I'm one of those evangelicals. I don't know if I am or not. I don't know if I qualify. Probably I don't, but just in case, I don't believe in the rapture. I don't think the rapture is scriptural. They got a lot of good argument. I've read the arguments. I've read the books on the subject matter. I know about when it came into existence, and I'm reporting that to you now. And so the point I'm making is, if I don't believe this, as Dr. LaHaye says, God, I'm going to hell. I don't think that Dr. LaHaye is going to hell because he doesn't believe what George Gordon believes. But Dr. LaHaye believes George Gordon is going to hell because I don't believe what Dr. LaHaye believes. Can both of us be right? I don't believe that. It's beyond my comprehension as to how LaHaye can be right and Gordon wrong, or Gordon wrong, or right, and LaHaye wrong. I don't think that we can believe the same, or believe opposites, and come to the same conclusion. Now, that's just me, I guess. Now, furthermore, psychiatrist Robert Coles writes that children in some parts of America are more frightened about the world than children in Lebanon or North Ireland. This may very well have to do with the fact that some of the most violent programming on television are cartoons aimed at very young children. The potential consequences of this are staggering. A generation brought up to fear the world may be more willing to do unhealthy things in order to protect themselves from things that aren't there, such as a readiness to sacrifice their basic civil liberties for a false sense of security. Does that remind you of the Patriot Act? Homeland Security? Well, it sure does me. Now, I'm not sure that viewing all of this violence makes me psychotic or in some way changes me psychologically. I read it in the light of Bible prophecy. You know, Jesus told us in Matthew 24 to watch. So I'm out busily watching the world. Watching what? What was it he was talking about? He was talking about international geopolitics in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. So I'm busily watching international geopolitics. The other day there was a big earthquake over in the Indian Ocean. It's being reported every night on the news. 150,000 dead. Probably that many or more injured. 5 million people left homeless. Billions of dollars worth of damage. It's being reported that earthquake and tidal wave, seismic wave, made the region into what observers said reminded them of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Total destruction. Do you know what Jesus had to say about that? He said in Matthew 24 that earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars are just the beginning. We're not in the tribulation. This is just the beginning of it. He said, don't be too concerned about this. Don't let this get under your skin. This is just the beginning of it. All right, now if this is just the beginning, then this thing called the Great Tribulation is going to be biblical in its scope. That's what Dan Rather said. But Dan Rather used the word biblical in scope on the news last night. I would tend to agree with him. I think that this is biblical in scope. And I think that a 9 on the Richter scale earthquake with a tidal wave that kills 150,000 people in about 10 minutes. I think that's pretty significant. It's pretty biblical. I mean, that's pretty big time, isn't it? And that's what Dr. LaHaye said that he was trying to do. He's trying to alert all of us. He wants to alert me. He's trying to get George Gordon to read his books. He wants me to be informed. And I'm sure he wants me to believe in the rapture. And I'm sitting here saying, well, let's suppose that I don't believe in the rapture. But let's suppose that I obey God and keep His commandments. Let's suppose that I don't bed down, I don't commit adultery with my neighbor's wife, and I don't practice fornication, and I don't steal, I don't lie, I don't cheat. Let's suppose I follow the Ten Commandments, but I don't believe in the rapture. Well, what would you do with me if you were God? Would you throw me into hellfire for all of eternity because I didn't believe in the rapture? Isn't the rapture a benefit that you get for being a good guy? Isn't the rapture, the people that are going to be raptured off, protected from this great tribulation? Wouldn't the people around the Indian Ocean basin have been lucky had they been raptured off before the earthquake occurred? If they had been protected from it, wouldn't that have been the benefit that they were looking for? No, just my common sense would tell me that that would make a lot of sense. That you want to be protected. And if you're not protected and you went through the tribulation, if I didn't believe in the rapture, but I was a good guy and I obeyed God and kept His commandments, wouldn't God protect me anyway? I mean, my common sense just says that if I'm as good as Tim LaHaye, and let's suppose Mr. LaHaye is a pretty good guy, and he follows the Ten Commandments. And I'm a pretty good guy, and I follow the Ten Commandments. I practice them rigorously. He believes in the rapture. I don't believe in the rapture. So is God going to leave me here on the planet and say, boy, I'm going to tune you up, Gordon. I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to kill you in a tidal wave. I'm going to put you through this great tribulation. Somehow or another, that eludes me. But there's more. It's very difficult for a human being to kill a member of their own species. It's difficult for human beings to kill other human beings. They have to be manipulated to do so. It's been estimated that during World War II, when individual riflemen were left to their own devices, only 15 to 20% of them would fire their weapon at an exposed enemy target. This was blamed primarily upon the training that they received in which they would practice shooting at a bullseye. Of course, bullseyes don't appear on the battlefield, and after the war, the military switched to human-shaped targets. By the time of the Vietnam War, 95% of the riflemen fired their weapons when the right opportunity arose. Today, the Marine Corps uses a modified version of the first-person action game Doom, known as Marine Doom, as a training device, along with the traditional live ammunition range targets as a means of normalizing killing amongst their personnel. In fact, this has been so successful that the Marine Corps Combat and Development Command in Quantico, Virginia, has evaluated more than 30 commercially available electronic games for their potential use as training tools. So this brings up a very interesting and a very disturbing question. If the U.S. military has acknowledged for decades the success that they have achieved by using human-like targets to normalize killing, what then is the effect of the same or similar games on children, where the objective is the near indiscriminate killing of the enemy using toy guns? With this in mind, then, the rise of school shootings should come as no surprise, then, should it? Now, you'll notice where this author is taking us. Mind control. I mean, that's what the bottom line is. Mind control. Now, I reported to you mind control, world control, and if you will go to the website georgegordon.org, click on to the archives. You can go back to a group of programs that I did on mind control. Let me just cite for you. Let me make a mark right here so I don't lose my place there. In Chapter 4 of Mind Control, listen to this from our public schools. One of the major world arenas in which Hegelian philosophy and the materialistic anti-psychology of want has been applied is that of education. In 1819 in Prussia, the first compulsory schooling for children was instituted. You want to know where public school comes from? 1819, Prussia, Germany. According to educator John Taylor Ghetto, society in Prussia was divided into children who will become policymakers, children who will become assistants to the policymakers, that is, the engineers, the architects, the lawyers, and doctors, and then finally, the children who will be the vast, massed, used workers. Did you get that? Education divides children into three classes. Prussia sets up a three-tier school system in which one half of 1% of the population is taught to think. They go to school called academia. 5.5% of the population go to real schooling, where they partially learn to think, but not completely. Because Prussia believed that their defeat at the hands of Napoleon was caused by people thinking for themselves at times of stress on the battlefield. They were going to see to it that scientifically this could never happen again. Now, the lowest 94%, that's the vast majority of all the people. Now, that's some pyramid, isn't it? They went to Volksschulen, where they were to learn harmony, obedience, freedom from stressful thinking, how to follow orders. And they worked out a system that would, in fact, guarantee just such a result. In the Volksschulen, it was to divide whole ideas, which really simultaneously participate in math, science, social thinking, language, and art. And they broke them up into subjects which hardly had existed before, to divide the subjects further into units, to divide the time into small enough units of time, with enough variations in the course of a day so that no one would know what was going on. No one would know what was going on. Now, in the middle of the last century, a member of the secret Skull and Bone Society, following in the Prussian tradition, set in motion an American educational revolution that has subverted the entire system toward the goals of the New World Order. That man was Daniel Coit Gilman, first president of Johns Hopkins University and of the Carnegie Institution. Gilman studied Hegelian philosophy at the University of Berlin in 1854. Gilman came from a family of bonesmen. And during the same period, Skull and Bones covertly took over the administration of Yale University with the presidency of the school. From that period forward, it had been turned over to a succession of aluminized bonesmen. George Bush, our president, is an aluminized bonesman. Now, Gilman met with Frederick T. Gates, who ran Rockefeller Foundation, and he implored him to set up the Southern Education Board, merging the Slater and Peabody funds. Gilman called the foundation the General Education Board, signaling its intentions. The organization was later renamed the Rockefeller Foundation. Gilman was the first president of Johns Hopkins University, and he carefully chose for the faculty members from the Skull and Bones and other groups of the Hegelian stripe. Among those was G. Stanley Hull, the first of once American students to make a mark. Hull's training in Leipzig was paid for by a loan from a member of Scroll and Key, a sister society to Skull and Bones at Yale. According to Hall, the psychology that I taught was almost entirely experimental, and it covered for the most part the material that Wundt had set forth in the latter and larger edition of physiological psychology today. In 1889, Hall was chosen as the first president of the newly established Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hall was a mentor of one of the most influential names in American education in this century. His name was John Dewey. Dewey studied under Hall at Johns Hopkins, moving on to teach at the universities of Michigan and Minnesota. Another major influence upon Dewey was the Hegelian philosopher George Morris, who had received his doctorate from the University of Berlin. According to Dewey, echoing the sentiments of his Prussian mentors, "There is no God. There is no soul. There are no needs for the props of traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or permanent moral absolutes." All right, now, in America today, we have followed that educational format, and we divide our children into three groups. One half of 1% are taught to think. Those are the children that go to the prep schools. Those are the children of Ted Kennedy. The professionals, the ones that go to Yale, Harvard, Princeton, those are taught partially to think, and they had business. Those are the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers. Those people can partially think. And then there's all the rest of us. Now, what does that tell us? Is it any wonder that we have, in this country, the vast majority of people manipulated by the media? Should you wonder, should you be absolutely amazed at the way people in this country behave? As the writer pointed out, he said, now, you feed your children on this violence on television, and then you wonder why you have these school shootings. In World War II, they could only get 15 to 20% of soldiers to shoot at another human being on the other side. Today, it's 95%. It's a matter of conditioning. It's a matter of training. It's a matter of belief. Belief. If I want you to believe something, to accept something, to act upon something, evolutionary philosophy, Catholicism, the rapture, I have to get you to believe it. How do I get you to believe it? Well, I start with vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. The five motivators of human nature. Hey, I'm running out of time. We're almost to the end of this program. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Remember, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School or the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal that says my time's up. I got to leave it right there, boys and girls. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. We'll take it up right here where we left off, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.